We'll get into today's podcast in just a moment. Our podcast made possible by KPP Financial. KPP created a strategy designed to accommodate investors who have a lower risk tolerance but still desire some exposure to the potential growth of the stock market. Learn about our balanced income program. When you're ready, just go to investtalk.com and click on the Investments tab. And now, today's Invest Talk.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for being with us on this Monday edition of Invest Talk. And we're all about above-average investing for the average investor. So we're here to be a resource that maybe help you expand your decision-making skills, giving you some perspective on today's money marketplace and answer some questions, financial questions you might have. Today we're going to talk about mismatch between the complexity of financial decisions we have to make and our own financial knowledge. So that's going to be our talking point. Five things you likely have wrong about investing. Five things we likely have wrong about investing. So how do the changes in the federal funds rate affect the U.S. dollar? I mean, does that change anything? All it really is telling us is the direction has changed. But it's painfully slow change. I mean, microscopically slow change in the Fed's attitude. But is that going to change with a new president? I want to talk about that in more details later on. So in the past years, since 2008 financial crisis, the Fed has maintained a pretty, almost a zero rate, Fed fund rate of zero. That's no longer going to be the case. Hasn't been the case since last December when they made the first change. So the Fed uses rates as a way to speed up or slow down the economy. The Fed uses rates, moving rates up and down, as a way to control inflation. That's what it's all about for the Federal Reserve, increasing or decreasing rates. Now, this got all distorted in the financial crisis. It got all distorted because the Fed lowered them so dramatically down to zero. Never had that happen before. So that's what the Fed is doing with rates. And try to remember, they only control one rate, the federal funds rate. They don't control your mortgage rates or how much a bank charges in interest for making a loan or what the bank pays in dividends or yields to savings accounts. They have no control of any other junk rates, corporate bond rates, what corporate bond rates are. They don't control any of that, none of that. They do not control rates at all except for one, the federal funds rate. And what is the federal funds rate? That's the rate that when banks come to the Federal Reserve to borrow money, that's the rate. So if a bank wants to borrow money, goes to the Federal Reserve, I'd like to borrow, $1 billion. The federal funds rate is, okay, you're going to pay 0.75 or 0.50 interest rate for that money. So the bank takes the money and then lends it to you and me for 5% or 3% or 8%. So as the federal funds rate increases, the bank has incentive to raise rates to their customers because their cost of funds is going up. That's it. How about inflation? So how do these rates change inflation and how does it affect the dollar? How does it affect your portfolio? Do you know? We're going to talk about that, hopefully in more detail. Let's open up the discussion right now to include you. As always, we're up for any money questions you might have. So let's begin with the Q&A portion of the program. Let's go to our 24-hour listener line, 888-99-CHART is our anytime number.
I got a question. Well, first off, when you talk about the Consumer Confidence Index, what exactly goes into that index?
It's a pretty simple thing. I think it's called the Michigan Consumer Confidence, Michigan something, some college. They're the ones I think ask. It's a survey. How do you feel about the economy? What's your confidence? It's asking people, consumers. They ask a series of questions, And I don't know exactly how it's constructed, because I never looked at it, but it's merely what the consumer thinks and how they answer the questions. And they score it, and they give it a score, a number. That's it. Nothing magical about it. That's just it. That's one of the reasons why I don't like it very much. Because what if you get, what if you're asked, taking the survey just after, you know, a worldwide disaster like the nuclear tidal wave that wiped out Japan's and caused massive problems there for with our nuclear power plants. If you ask them right after that event, it's on everybody's mind. Their confidence is going to be low. See, consumer confidence doesn't translate necessarily into consumer spending, which is really key. You want to know what the consumer is doing, not what they think. What they think can change. But when they spend money, that, you know, that's hard evidence of what they're actually doing. Okay? Good question, though. Five things you'd likely have wrong about investing. That's going to be our main talking point. And, you know, China backed several electric car company startups here in the United States. You know anything about Lucid, L-U-C-I-D? It's taking on Tesla. Thought that was kind of fun to talk about that a little bit. And where are the retirees moving to and why? And this is a survey of affordability, low taxes, great weather. Those are the reasons, cultural, recreation, those are the reasons they're moving. But where are they going? And where are they leaving? I find that leaving states. What states are they going to and what states are they leaving? I find the leaving states pretty interesting. So those are what we're going to talk about today, unless, of course, you want to talk about something in particular. And that's hopefully you do. 888-99-CHARTER is our number, 888-992-4278. Okay, let's go talk to Art in Menlo Park. How you doing, Art?
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank
you. I just got a question about my 401k.
Okay.
When I reach 59 and a half, I guess you can start taking distributions. Is that correct?
That is correct. At 65, I believe you can start. Are you still working at your employer?
Yes.
Okay, and it's 65, I believe, is the age. You can even take it at 62 in certain circumstances. Again, you need to probably talk to an accountant to get the real answer. Remember, it's not my expertise, but I believe you can take it even younger if you want to. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it, but you could.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because actually my question was going to be, when you start taking distributions, can you take varying amounts, or does it have to be one set amount?
Okay, good. That's a good question. When you're in a 401k at age, unless it's a Roth, if it's a regular 401k, which it probably is, or an IRA, you have to start taking it at age 70 and a half. And that is if you are not working for them. There are different rules. Let's say you're still working. You know, you're 70 and you're still working. I'm not sure about that rule. But if you're not working, you have to start taking IRA and 401k redistributions at 70 and a half, the year that you reach 70 and a half.
Yeah, because actually the other part of the question was going to be, if I'm still working and I'm able to take distribution, I was just wondering if you could take, for example, 2% one year and then the following year, like, take 3%. And then...
No, at 70 and a half, the government has a formula that says, okay, at 70 and a half, you're going to live till you're 90, therefore you need to take this much percent of your, you're told what you have to do. But again, if you're working, Art, if you're working past 70, there may be rules that I'm not aware of and that you need to talk to an accountant about.
Oh, okay.
If you're working.
All right, Steve.
Okay, but if you're not working, you have to take it based on the government's formula.
But if you're working and you're under 70 and a half, I guess you can't take distributions at all?
No, you can take them all out if you want. As long as you're past 65, you can take it all out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're working or not then.
That's right.
You get to be in the higher tax bracket, I guess.
That's right. That's what I was going to tell you. You're pushing yourself into the highest tax bracket there is, but you can still take them out.
Oh, okay.
Now, see, it depends on how much money you make and what tax bracket you're in. So, let's say you make $50,000, you take out $25,000. I put you up an income of $75,000. That's going to be a higher tax bracket.
Right.
So you're going to have to pay more taxes. So you want to kind of play with it, not to pay the least amount of taxes you can, Art. And an accountant will help you with that.
Okay, Steve.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks for the information.
That's a good call. Right. Thank you. Very good call. Thank you, Art. I appreciate it. This is InvestTalk. Remember, we're not all stocks and bonds. Any questions that you might have, any question financial is on the table. Rears, mortgages, insurance, real estate. 888-99-CHART. That's our InvestTalk, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, listener line.
Listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
We're going to go to Chris and Hayward. How are you doing, Chris?
I was just curious, flipping through the dials and listening to you, I was curious that there's been so much online infomercials and stuff like that. In fact, I even attended recently a Teach Me to Trade type, and I don't know anything about stock. They obviously were really flashy and had a lot of information. I was curious if I can get your opinion on that kind of stuff.
Unfortunately, people make it sound like it's super exciting. You can get in and out. You buy it at the bottom, sell at the top, and you could do this, and everybody could do this. Chris, to be honest, it's a lot harder than it seems.
Yeah.
It really is. The stock market moves up when earnings increase. That's as simple as that. If you have a company that makes money and it makes more and more money, eventually the stock price will move up. The problem, Chris, is it's not a perfect correlation. In other words, if my earnings go up today, the stock doesn't go up today. Because all of us guys, me included, are looking for next year because I want to be ahead of everybody else. We're all competing with each other. So, Chris, if I can mention just one thing to put in your head. Stock prices move up on earnings. Now, I know you're going to say, and it is true, well, you got stocks that go up all the time that don't have earnings. Yes, that's true. Those are called story stocks. They have a great story. I have the next cure for cancer. The stock will shoot up.
Right.
But in fact, if they don't come out with that cure for cancer, that stock will shoot right back down and go lower. So that's a story that they don't have it yet, that they're working on it. Earnings actually means I have made money, I am making money, I'm putting it in my pocket, and you as a stockholder, remember you own this company, you have made money. If you don't believe me, look at Microsoft over all its history. It's gone up 10,000% since it started. Thousands and thousands of percent. It's because it's always made money. It has not moved in 2 years and still makes a lot of money. That's why I mean it's not a perfect correlation.
Right, I hear you.
That can happen to you. But if you're going to be in this game any length of time, Chris, buy stocks that make money. You'll be a lot happier in the long run.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the call. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. So what are some of the myths, busted myths about investing? What are some of them? One, you know what you're buying when you buy an ETF. People think when they buy an ETF, they know what it is. First of all, ETFs, are, especially ones using derivatives, are extremely complex, convoluted. It's very difficult to know what you own. It's not that simple. If you own an ETF that buys the S&P 500, ETF index fund, then you know what you own. There's a massive amount of them that don't. Here's another myth. Stocks are risky. Well, if you're talking about a broad equity index, it's hard to say. They're going to go down with the market, up with the market, but they generally go up with the earnings of the companies, and the earnings of the company go up with the GDP of the country, and if that's moving forward up, then the risk is quite small over long periods of time. How about third one? Bonds are safe. That is so wrong. Bonds can be very risky if interest rates are moving. How about stock investing is easy? We're talking about individual stocks, very complex. It's not easy. I wish it was easy. It's just not. And finally, options are speculative and dangerous. It depends on how you use them. They're, in and of themselves, options are not speculative and dangerous. It's how you use them. Don't use leverage. Don't. Our direct line, 888-99-CHART, is live between 4 and 5 Pacific time, 888-992-4278. This is Invest Talk. We'll be right back.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
Let's go to Fred in San Diego. How you doing, Fred?
Hi. I would like to know, are there any general guidelines for setting a hedge position? Take a generic one. In other words, what I'm concerned about is how to set those proportions. Would it have anything to do with the proportion of the numeric risk at the time you set it? In other words, for example, if you want to set a hedge for the index of the S&P or the NDX, how would you proportion it?
For everybody else, let's make sure we understand what a hedge means. A hedge, everybody, means that you're in a position and you want to protect it from going down. Most common hedges are they're in a position, you made a lot of money, it's been going up, and you want to hedge it or hedge the whole portfolio against a fall in the market. So that means you put on positions that will go up when everything, it goes in the opposite direction, what it wants to do. So Fred's asking, well, is there rules as to how much of a hedge?
Yes, in other words, how much would you put into going long or short to create that hedge?
Okay.
Would it have anything to do with what you assess the risk, numeric risk at that time would be? In other words, if you assess that the numeric risk is 3 going long and 1 going short, would it be have anything to do with that?
There's many ways to hedge. You can hedge with options.
Just take a generic, long, short position, which can be done with the ETFs.
Well, let's say you feel that the odds of the market are going up or continuing to go up are very strong. You have to determine that, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Just say you think it's 3-1. In that situation, you wouldn't want to put more than 25% a short position. For instance, let's say you have a portfolio of stocks that you like and you still think they're going to go up, but you're worried about the overall market. You can short the overall market, but still hold on to your positions because some of them still may go up, but even though the market goes down. But how much is that is basically what you think the risk is.
But there's no general guidelines.
No.
Okay.
It's all individual and how much risk are you comfortable with.
Okay.
Thanks, Fred. Appreciate the call. 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278. I do have an email question. Hi, Steve. This is a question for your InvestTalk podcast. Fall of Amazon, I've started to notice a shift in purchasing directly from Chinese websites versus Amazon. Banggood.com, AliExpress, Alibaba. I've also noticed Banggood.com are offering more shipping choices from their in-country warehouse. So what is your opinion of this trend? How would you position yourself to benefit if this trend continues? Thank you for your great show. Look, Amazon, it was first, it is the biggest, and it is probably the best. But like any other leader, everybody's going to chase it. Everybody's going to try to shoot it down. Everybody's going to go after it, right? So I just think, you're going to have competition come around, and some of them are going to be successful, and some of them will fall by the wayside. Won't matter at all. Of the group you mentioned, I think Alibaba is probably the biggest and the best of that group. But Amazon will have successful competition, just like Apple came out with their new phones, mini touch screens, and everybody was whining that, the keyboard's too small and people couldn't touch the right letters and they wanted a raised keyboard. And of course, then Amazon took over. And then as soon as they started to explode in cell phones because those complaints were worthless, then all of a sudden everybody else copied. And now they have tough, tough competition. Amazon's going to have the same thing. It's just the nature of free economic efforts. Everybody's going to go after the most successful ones. And that's another reason why it's very difficult for small startup companies to break in with compete with the big boys. It's difficult for them. So I'm saying that I like Amazon. I think some of these competitors are going to do well, and we're just going to have to live with competition. It's healthy. It's good. Amazon is way overpriced, by the way, in case anybody wanted to ask me that. Yeah, it's way overpriced. But appreciate the call. I mean, the question. Thank you. 888-99-CHART. David Berkeley. How you doing, David?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling.
My question has to do with the fact that my son is getting married in December, and to pay for my part of the wedding, I need to generate some liquid cash.
Okay.
And I was thinking of one of two ways to do that. One is I have a Roth IRA, mm-hmm. which I have about $85,000.
Okay.
I also have a couple of index mutual funds that I would have to sell to get the cash.
Okay.
That I would have to pay some capital gains.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering which might be the better way to go to generate that cash.
Let me ask you how old you are, David.
I'm 63.
Okay, so are you able to take money out of that Roth without any tax consequences?
I am. It's been over 5 years.
Okay. I'm really opposed to paying taxes wherever possible.
Okay, yeah.
If you have no other sources, and those are the only two choices you're giving me, I would go with the Roth. And I'd rather see you stay in at least for the next 3 months. I would wait as long as I can, even in the Roth. You want to just play the odds and see if you can get a little bit extra growth out of it. And I'd take it out of the Roth just because of the tax issues.
Okay.
Okay?
Very helpful.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate the call. Welcome to your money questions and comments, 888-99-CHART. That's how you can get through right now. I'm Financial Advisor Steve Peasley, and I'm glad you're with us today, and you're listening to Invest Talk.
We thank you for subscribing to the podcast. There's really no good reason not to sign up for our InvestTalk Insiders program. One reason to join is our long list of lists. One of them is our Dividend Growth Watch List. Many investors today are chasing yield, but in a rising rate environment, high-yielding stocks tend to suffer. Here are 10 names that have a long track record of dividend growth. You can see them instantly when you sign up to be an InvestTalk Insider. Do that for free on InvestTalk.com. You're listening to an encore presentation of InvestTalk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next InvestTalk.
Kevin Tracy, how you doing, Kevin?
Good, good. I was just curious about what kind of programs you guys use to for a stock valuation.
Well, we have a number of systems that we use with various different calculations, and we try to give you a number, so we, you know, set up a range as close as we can. There's a very simple way if you want to do it yourself, which we use often just to see if there's a valuation. We take next year's earnings, figure out what that growth rate from this year, if it's going up 10%, 20%, and then multiply that times earnings per share. So if it's going up 20%, it's a $2 earnings per share, 20 times 2 is a $40 stock. It's a very simple way to evaluate a stock. To get a valuation. There's other things we use. We use interest rates. We use some pretty sophisticated formulas.
Yeah, and it depends on the company as well, whether it's a cyclical company or is it something that has a long-term steady trend that you don't really have to worry about the business cycle affecting its earnings dramatically. And then that's also very important because there's companies that are coming out of recession growing 40, 50%. But as the economic cycle, you know, kind of peters out or we go back into some sort of a dip in the economy, then that obviously will turn around quickly.
So it's much more complex than just saying, well, here's a stock and that is the valuation. There's a lot of things that go into it, sector, interest rates, the mortgage, you know, a bunch of things. A bunch of things go into it.
Right.
So it's really difficult, Kevin.
What do you discount it at? Do you discount it at the S&P 500s, or do you discount it at, like, a treasury fund?
Many of our calculations use the 10-year treasury, based on that. There's competition for money between bonds, U.S. treasury, because it's ultra-safe, there's no risk, and then
right.
risk, which is stocks. So we like to use the Treasury. Kevin, appreciate the call. Thank you.
Thanks.
Harry in San Jose. How you doing, Harry?
Hey, doing good, Steve. Long-time listener and appreciate the education you provide on the show. I had a question regarding 401k rollover. I am rolling over my 401k to an IRA with my bank. And as the usual stuff, I have set up an appointment with the advisor with my bank. I wanted to know if I don't want to be a couch potato investor and if I want to actively manage my funds, how should I go about, what would you recommend?
Well, I don't know if I would roll it over into a bank, because a bank is kind of limits you to whatever they're going to offer you. Now, he's going to, you know, a bank employee is, you know, they have people that offer you mutual funds and a few things, but are you going to try to do it yourself, Harry?
I'm planning to do it myself, and I can trade stocks and mutual funds options on through my bank account. I have a brokerage account with them.
Okay, yes. And the trade fees are low?
I get up to 100 trades free per year, and after that it's around $7.99.
Okay, that's not too bad. Then that's what you should do. You could use the bank. I don't have a problem with it. It's just I thought they might be limiting you to, you know, because most banks you can't buy stocks. It depends on the bank, obviously. No, I have no problem with that. And you control and decide what you want to buy and sell. There's no issues there. Now, what you need to do, though, Harry, is learn how to manage that portfolio of stocks or ETFs or mutual funds, whatever you're going to be. And kind of don't buy too much of any one thing. There's rules that you got to kind of understand, so you don't get wiped out in one bad trade, you know what I mean? So be very, very careful there.
Got it.
Okay, yeah, but I have no problem with what you're doing. Sounds all right.
Perfect. Thanks
Harry. Appreciate the call. Okay, China had started a number of years ago before the financial crisis. They invested in a number of startups here in the U.S. for electric cars. And now they're doing it again. They have funded a startup called... I don't know if you heard this company called Lucid Motors, L-U-C-I-D. It's in Silicon Valley, Lucid Motors. They're now taking orders for their Model S car that's going to be produced in 2018. It's a luxury car. They couch it in terms of competing with Tesla and their luxury car. So they're coming out with a brand new. Now, if you go to their website, which I did, L-U-C-I-D, Motors, to see, well, let's take a look at the car. You'll see no pictures of the car. You get very little information on their website about this. It's a nice, professionally done website, but there's no real information on it. So, but, you know, Tesla, I bring this up because, you know, you have these startups going after Tesla, just like Amazon we talked about before. You're going to have Ford, GM, Toyota, Hyundai, every other car company is going to be coming after Tesla, just like everybody's coming after Amazon. Tesla has the lead. They have a really sharp car. But don't think that's going to last forever. Other competition is going to come in. And again, remember, I think competition is very good. You want competition. Helps keep prices low. For us, me and you, the consumer, and it keeps the companies sharp, staying on the cutting edge, trying to anyways. So just let you know, Tesla is a great company. I'm not, I've said on this show many times that I think Tesla is going to be the next big car company. The problem is I don't necessarily see it being the next big car company with the current stockholders. That means they could file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, come out of Chapter 11 because they have so much debt, come out as a much cleaner and leaner car company, but you, the stockholder, gets wiped out. And now they have new stockholders in the new company coming out of Chapter 11, the new Tesla. That's what GM did during the financial crisis. Stockholders got ripped off royally. Let's go to Gene in North Carolina. How you doing, Gene?
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Steve.
Thank you.
Yeah, you were talking just recently about phase 1, 2, and 3 clinical trials for drugs.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to make a slight correction. Sure. Phase 3 is the major trial that, if they get it approved through the FDA, they can get the drug marketed. But phase 1 and 2 usually do involve human subjects.
They do? That's news
to
me.
They, it's just that it's the only test for phase one, the only test for safety, not for efficacy, whether the drug works. They only test to see if the drug's tolerated or if the person vomits or has some kind of adverse event. The ones that the trials that involve animals are usually called preclinical trials.
Okay. So you can see I don't have a lot of knowledge on that.
Yeah, so phase one and two are with people. It's just it's a smaller number of subjects, and it's usually just for safety and just the very first instances of efficacy, whether the drug works. But it's not enough to get it approved.
I see. So phase three is total efficacy of how well the drug works on people.
And still safety, of course.
And still safety. Okay. Well, I appreciate
that. And it's with a large enough population, they can do statistics on it.
Gene, I appreciate that information because that's vital information. And I appreciate the correction. Thank you.
No problem.
Okay. Thank you. So phase one and two can involve people and does involve people, but only for safety. In other words, it doesn't hurt you. They're looking to see if it's going to not hurt you. Phase three is where they do to see how good the drug works. And he says, and I have no reason to doubt him whatsoever. So that's good information. I always thought phase one and two did not involve people, but there you go. What do I know? I don't know everything, that's for sure. That's one of the reasons I love this job, by the way. You learn all kinds of new stuff. I'll try to remember that. 888-99-CHART is time for our InvestTalk 101. How much do you really know about Roth IRAs? How much do you really know about all IRAs, regular and Roth? So we're going to have a little bit of quiz. In order to take advantage of these programs, Roth and regular IRA programs, you have to follow a number of federal tax rules, both when putting money in and when taking money out. So here's the question. Your upfront contributions to a Roth IRA are tax deductible. True or false? The upfront contributions to a Roth IRA are tax deductible. True or false? That's false. They're not tax deductible. A traditional IRA, they are tax deductible, but not a Roth. You get no tax deductions for putting money in a Roth. Next question. You can withdraw your contributions from a Roth IRA tax-free right away. But there are restrictions on withdrawing your earnings. Is that true or false? Can you withdraw contributions from a Roth tax-free right away? Can you do that? The answer is true. Yeah. You can withdraw your contributions immediately, but you cannot. You cannot withdraw your earnings from that investment. That, you have to wait till you're 59 and a half years old. Next question. There's no age limit for contributing to a Roth, as long as you or your spouse have earned income to contribute. True or false? True. You can be 100 years old. As long as you're making income, you can contribute it to it. Last question. There are separate annual limits for contributing to a traditional IRA and a Roth IRA. True or false? False. The annual IRA, whether it's traditional or Roth, the annual IRA contribution this year is $5,500. And if you're over 50, it could be $6,500. End of story. Now you can split up $3,000 a regular IRA and $2,500 in a Roth IRA. You can split it up, but total, you can't. That's your InvestTalk 101 today. Hope you learned something about that. It's kind of interesting, don't you think? 888-99-CHART, 888-992-4278.
Sometimes you need a fresh start, or at least a fresh look at your retirement planning. Is it still right for your current life situation? Each month, Steve sets aside some time to talk with listeners on a one-to-one basis, offering a second opinion about their retirement portfolio, offering some ideas and solutions. It can be done by Skype or telephone. If you'd like to reserve your hour to look over your documents and hear some suggestions, just go to investtalk.com and click on the InvestTalk tab and then portfolio review.
John in Oceanside. How you doing, John?
How you doing? I'm pretty good. My question is, I heard this rumor people been talking about. If you buy a stock that is interest and you reinvest the interest and hold on to that stock, eventually you get rich. Is that true?
Well, it depends. Well, that's kind of a broad statement. When you say you're talking about dividends, right? When you buy stock and it pays dividend. I'll tell you this. Dividends make up about 30 to 40% of the return of the S&P 500 over the last 100 years. Dividends are very, very important. So when you reinvest them, the answer is it will help greatly get you rich. But you have to buy the right dividend-paying stocks. You can't buy a stock that goes out of business in 20 years or 10 years.
Like ExxonMobil?
Yeah, ExxonMobil is a perfect example. It's going to last forever. You can buy a couple of drugs companies, you know, that pay very high dividends. You also want to buy companies that are growing, you know, growing their earnings and growing their dividends. So it's not just paying the dividends, but also increasing the dividends. So, John, you can build like a little portfolio of these high dividend-paying, growing companies, and you'll do very well over time.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Sid in Fremont. How you doing, Sid?
Hi, how are you?
Good. I haven't talked to you in a while.
I know. Well, I'm still here. Quick question.
Sure.
You haven't brought up closed-end funds. Do you consider closed-end products a good option or not?
Well, not if you're indexing. What I'm talking about is the index mutual funds or index ETF, because closed-end funds can trade not at the actual price of what they're worth, what those stocks are worth inside the ETF or mutual fund. They can trade at a discount or a premium, because closed-end funds is a finite number of shares. Therefore, there could be more demand or less demand for those number of shares. And so the price could be above what it should be or below what it should be. And that's what a closed-end fund does. Now, from a strategy point of view, Sid, if you wanted to buy an index and you can find a closed-end fund that's selling at a discount to the actual value, that might not be a bad way, because at some point it will probably go to either the value or premium at some point, right? Because it's an index.
Right.
It's just following a bunch of stocks, the S&P 500, and they shouldn't sell at much of a discount or a premium, because they're just tracking the index. That's all it's doing. But if something happened where it did sell at a discount, that might not be a bad way to go and buy it. Sid, I appreciate the call. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thanks very much.
Do you have questions about FDIC security, mortgages, money market funds, losses to your retirement plans? Give us a call today, 888-99-CHART.
Al in Silver Beach, how you doing, Al?
I have a managed account with your firm, I'm putting the maximum in a 401k, and I'm holding a couple of stocks that I've had forever.
Okay.
Can I benefit from a Roth? Would that lessen my taxes in the future? And what kind of investments can I put into a Roth? Can I put I-bonds, municipals, T-bonds, T-bills?
Yes, you can put anything you want in a Roth. You can put anything you want in an IRA, almost anything you want in both. How old are you?
I'm 44.
Okay.
The stocks that I've been holding, can I roll those into a Roth? I've had them forever.
Where are they now?
They're just in a reinvestment plan.
No, I don't think you can roll any positions into a Roth or a regular IRA from a normal account. You have to put in cash, then buy what you want from them.
Okay.
The answer to your question is yes. Why do I say yes? For everybody else, a Roth is something that you open up, a Roth IRA versus a regular IRA. You put money in there after tax. Whereas a regular IRA, the money you put in there, you don't have to pay income tax on. The reason why I'm telling you yes, Al, is because when you get to retirement, and the reason why I asked you your age,
yes, sir.
How many years you got left, okay?
Right.
But when you reach retirement, and you hinted at it, when you're 65, what if you're still working part-time somewhere? And you still, but you want to take money, you need money from your IRA account, it would be wiser to take money out of the Roth then, because you won't have to pay any taxes or income taxes on that money while you're paying income tax on the money that you're making, you're earning. When you eventually fully retire, the assumption is that you're going to be in less tax brackets. You're trying to keep the lowest taxes. Then you can start taking from your regular. Yeah, it gives you the freedom to pick and choose.
Okay.
I appreciate the call.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. You're listening to InvestTalk. If you have a question, we can talk live until 5 p.m. Pacific time. We're going into our last segment, 888-99-CHART, or anytime listener line, and we're here for you.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Invest Talk. Please call with your questions and comments, though, 888-99-CHART, 888-99-CHART, and Steve will answer them on the next Invest Talk.
888-99-CHART, let's talk to Walter in Berkeley. How you doing, Walter?
Pretty good. I'm doing good, Steve.
Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
My question is, can you open a Roth IRA with the proceeds of the sale of your primary residence?
Yes, you can, as long as you have earned income also. Do you have earned income? If your answer is no, yes, then you can't open up an IRA. You got to have earned income of at least for the amount. Let's say you made earned income of only $6,000. You can put $5,000 in an IRA. See, but
okay.
But yeah, you can. The money doesn't matter where the money comes from. It just, you do have to have earned income. Okay.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. How you doing, Manuel?
I love you guys' show. I've been listening for about 3 months, and I learned a lot of good stuff. My question for you today was, the company I work for matches us in our 401k with their own stock, and they're telling me that the stock's going to split. You know, I know then you end up with twice as many shares, but why does it split is my question.
Okay, good question, Manuel. I bet you there's a lot of people out there that want to know why it does that. Why does a company split? Do you know if it's going to split 2-for-1?
I'm not sure. Somebody, one of the other guys that's always paying attention to the 401k a lot more than I do will tell me that today.
Well, just to let you know that a most common split is 2 stocks for 1, but they don't do that all the time. Sometimes it's 3-for-2 or 5-for-3. You're going to do different ones.
Uh-huh.
But most common is 2-for-1, so we'll try to stick with that. So what's happening is you had one share before at, let's say it was $50 a share. Mm-hmm. Then you're going to have two shares at $25 a share. So you didn't really increase the value of your holdings at all. Splits do not increase the value of anything. Mm-hmm. They just give you more shares. Now, why would they do that? One of the main reasons they do that, Manuel, is to lower the price of the stock to make it more attractive for more people to buy. Think about this. What if the stock price was $1,500 per share? How many people would be able to buy 100 shares or 50 shares?
Not too many. Yeah.
That's right. So they keep splitting. Microsoft did this all throughout all its history when it first started. Split 2-for-1. So did Qualcomm. Qualcomm, which is a huge San Diego stock.
Actually, I owned Qualcomm before it split. So
You can see if it never split, the price would be so high that not too many people would buy it. The most common reason, Manuel, is that they wanted to lower the price to be more attractive to more people. The second reason they do it is to get more liquidity. In other words, if they split it 2-for-1, they have twice as many shares out there to trade. More liquid, more people can buy and sell. Same, it's related to the first reason, but that's the only reason why they split the shares.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Well, that answered my question. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening, Manuel. Appreciate the call. Where are the retirees going to and why? Well, the reasons are affordability, low taxes, weather, culture, recreation, opportunities, those kind of things. But I think it's more interesting where people are leaving. Number one state that people are retirees are leaving, is New York, followed by Illinois, followed by California, followed by Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Now, I can see New York, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey all weather-related and high-tax areas. California, not weather-related. It's all about high taxes and expenses, I'm sure. But where are they going? Number 10, Delaware, low property tax, very low property tax in Delaware. Number 9, Tennessee, low taxes in Tennessee. Nevada, climate, low taxes, one of the 7 states in the United States that doesn't have an income tax. Number 7 was the big surprise in this list, is Oregon, because Oregon has high taxes, expenses. I mean, maybe because of the recreation and maybe because of the culture, because it's very pretty up there. There's a lot of things to do. Maybe that's why. Number 6 is Texas. Great job market, great climate for a lot of people. Too hot for me, though. Just letting you know. Too hot. Number 5, North Carolina. Very low cost of living in general, North Carolina. Plus, it's nice. The weather, it gets cold, but it's not that cold. Number 4, Georgia. It's all about low taxes in Georgia. Number 3, South Carolina. low cost of living again. Good, much better weather there than in North Carolina. Number two, Arizona. Mostly because of the dry weather. But it gets pretty hot in Arizona. Yeah, but there's some really nice in northern Arizona, nice country up there. And number one, Florida. I don't know why. I would never live in Florida. Sorry, I can't handle the summers. I've been there during the summer. Can't handle them. Too hot. Too many bugs for me, too. Can't handle the bugs. The time is up for this hour. Remember, a cornerstone of sound investment portfolio management is an accurate understanding of risk. The risk you're comfortable with and the risk that's actually in your portfolio. What is that? And you can use our free risk analysis tool to find that out. It's right there on investtalk.com. I'm financial advisor Steve Peasley, president of KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm. And I, along with Justin Klein and everybody else at KPP, thank you for listening today. Love to see you tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.